Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. Today, I will be speaking with Maryam Zahr. She's an activist, podcast host, and the chair of the Westside Regional Alliance of Councils. And she is the mayor appointee of the LA Commission on the Status of Women. We will be talking about the effects of the protests on our community and policymaking. Then I will be speaking with Billy Manus. He is the author of Kick-Ass Recovery, From Your First Year Clean to the Life of Your Dreams. Be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel, Dr. Fujian Zain, Instagram, Dr. Fujian Zain, and Twitter, Dr. Zain. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Hello, listeners. This is Christopher from The Christopher Show. Hey, if you missed one of our shows here at KMET, don't worry about it. You can go to our webpage, and that's KMET1490AM.com. Go to the homepage, click on the SoundCloud tab, and hear any show anytime you want.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET 1490 AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
So this is the tip of the week. This week, I've been pondering on the notion of how is it that we have upgraded many aspects of our lives, such as our work, career, clothing, attire, technology, and cars, but many people are stuck in the very outdated way of relating to another human being. Many people get stuck in their early childhood emotional stages and never develop beyond how they used to treat each other, beyond kindergarten, or elementary school, or when they were teenagers. Some people have not upgraded their behaviors from 100 years ago, although they insist to have the latest phone or the gadgets that comes in the market. How come? Could it be that people see and experience the new technology, enjoy the experience and see others using it, see the benefits of it, and therefore want to upgrade and be a part of the society that chooses to utilize these new products or styles of living? Maybe when it comes to the emotional and behavioral practices, people will only upgrade as the people whom they surround themselves with, so that a community has some familiarity in their interactions with each other. Much of people's behaviors had to get upgraded when they worked in large corporations and had to change their practices at least for 8 to 10 hours that they were at work, but they never transferred it to their socialization or their home environment. What can be done? An adult state behavior that matches the 21st century can be defined as caring, cooperative, accepting, kind characters, characters who can regulate their emotions and can behave in a non-threatening, respectful way with others while negotiating their differences in a respectful and win-win approach. Each person can first learn and update one's own state of being, thought forms, emotional management, and behaviors, and support their own family and community to upgrade their way of being. It's important to have the intention and the motivation to upgrade our communication skills to match who we are as an adult and to what is needed in a healthy relationship, healthy workplace, healthy community, healthy country, and at large, a healthy world that we're living. So observe yourself. Is any part of your character, thought process, beliefs, emotional states, or behaviors stuck in a younger version of you? Or an outdated time that is no longer relevant? If the answer is yes, then become intentional about upgrading those parts of you so you could be whole and complete and up to date as you deserve to be, so we can all live together in a community that we all deserve to share. Thank you. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with great interviews.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it. Are you afraid? Are you getting panic attacks? Are you getting bored and can't stand it anymore at your home? Are you finding yourself in a bind with a relationship at home? Are you wondering what all of the fuss is? And are you determined to guard yourself against all others? Or worried about how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage? In respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering a sliding scale online psychotherapy for anyone in California and life coaching to anyone in the world who's suffering financially. Please connect with me at Fujian.com, F-O-O-J-A-N.com.
Take KMET 1490 AM with you everywhere you go by downloading our free smartphone apps found on the KMET website, KMET1490AM.com. You can also go to the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store on your phone to download the free app. Now you can listen live or play any of your favorite programmers' podcasts using your smartphone. Don't miss out on the free KMET smartphone apps. Go to KMET1490AM.com and download your free phone app today.
Welcome back to the Inner Voice Show. I am excited to be with a very close friend. And I invited her to come in because I know she's got amazing information for us. Mariam Zahr, she is the West Side Regional Alliance of Councils. And she's an activist, and she's the LA City Commission on the Status of Women by Mayor Garcetti. She was appointed by Mayor Garcetti for that. She's a contributor to Huffington Post and the NPR programs and a podcast host. And I'm glad to have you, and thank you with a very, very short notice, Mariam. You accepted my invitation, so thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. I'm always happy to come back to this show because you and I always end up having these really great conversations that dig deep into the issues of the day. I mean, we've talked about refugees, we've talked about homelessness. Today, we're going to talk about everything that's going on. So it's always a pleasure to show up and talk to you.
Thank you. I'm very saddened, obviously, by all that's happening. I think all of us are. And there's a lot going on, obviously. There's a conversation about violence. There's a conversation about police brutality. There's a conversation about Black lives, systematic racism. And then on top of that, we also have a group that is adding to all of this for more violence and more looting and robbery and all of the above. And it's bringing participants and also viewers and people who are sitting at home and watching in such a different array of experiences, emotions, opinions. Yeah. So let's open it up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you're right. There's a lot to unpack here, a lot to talk about, and certainly a lot going on. This is all happening on the heels of a pandemic, of a coronavirus crisis that has had people cooped up inside for a long time, and also, at least in this country and really across the world, people dealing with the fact that there's been death in their communities. So I do think it's a terrible time to have a crisis on top of a crisis. I think, as you say, there's a lot to unpack and we can talk about all of it. But I want to open it up by saying, by just pointing out the generations that are involved here. So I was in downtown LA, or I was in Midtown LA, the Fairfax District, on Saturday because there was supposed to be a protest. And although the Black Lives Matter movement is something that I've tracked and I support, and even though the George Floyd incident and murder was something that really impacted me, I wouldn't have gone down to those protests but for my 18-year-old daughter, who's a freshman in college, who, and my other two kids, who are alarmed by what they see, who walked into my space and said, "Mom, I'm going to go to the protest tomorrow." And I thought, you know what? She's 18. It's her first protest. I'm going to go with her. And then there are the older people, both Iranian from our community as well as everyone else across the state, who have seen these kinds of incidents, who've seen the fallout of these incidents, who've seen the riots and the protests and the promises for change, and it hasn't come through. So they're almost desensitized and they've disengaged. And so they watch it on TV and they make the judgment calls that they make, but they're a generation that I think to some degree has even given up hope, right? And then there's me, there's our middle generation who's still saying, maybe there's a way to change policies. Let's talk about the policies. And then there's the younger generation that says, change can't come fast enough. I'm going to walk out there and I'm going to demand it. And that's going on too, right? It's a generation that's, gotten used to having a voice, that to internet and technology has given them the ability to be connected and have a voice. You know, young people vote when they're 18 years old. They're voting in higher and higher numbers. So it's a little bit different this time around because there are more voices at the table and there are people who are very impatient for change.
Right. And I think that it's beautiful to have all the voice united, because I think that many of the atrocities or abuses can go on when there are no united voices.
Yeah.
I remember the Me Too movement. There were a lot of women always being abused everywhere for centuries. Yeah.
And they were voiceless.
They were voiceless because they were here and there. And although there were a lot, but they weren't togetherness into
it.
So I think that
there wasn't a unity of voice.
Yes. So the togetherness is amazing and it needs to be there. And definitely when it comes to African Americans, they, of course, they need to be there. And not only for African Americans to be there, for all of us to
be there. For everybody to be there.
Yeah, for all of us to support what's going on in order for this not to happen to any race, to any, you know, anyone who appears to be abused by another group. The message sometimes gets lost, though, when it, you know, it is with violence on another realm. And I think that when the other type of violence comes in, not only it loses the conversation, but also it's proving to the negative, like it's minimizing their effect. And I really wish that the message for the Black Lives Matter gets stronger for the message it is. And then it gets disconnected and distinct between the other group who are using this moment in, because they're also going through pain, or they're going through anger and rage, or they're going through poverty right now. And, you know, all that's happening for them, 40 million people not having jobs, and their anger and rage is going out. And I think these are two different types of message of anger and rage, which are coming together at this point.
Yeah, you're right. And there's a lot there again, too. You know, there's an old saying in the journalism world, and that is that light, shining the light on something, can disinfect it, right? So shining a light on injustice or corruption is usually the best cleanser. And I feel like with police brutality, and there's no one who can deny that there's been police brutality for years in this country and that it's almost systemic. The reality is that these days, with the ready availability of a recording device in everyone's hand, the reality is that more light gets shined on these incidents, which are not one-offs. They're not bad apples. They're happening all the time. We just don't see them. If it hadn't been for an 18-year-old girl who had a camera in her hand and had the stamina to stand there and record this thing for a good 11 minutes, we would never know what happened to George Floyd. He would have been he would have been dead and gone without an exclamation point in history. And I think that that's where the rage comes. It's the realization, at least for the African-American community, that this is happening in their community all the time, every day, every month, every year, and it's going without notice. You know, there are a lot of sayings, I'm into sayings these days, there are a lot of sayings about riots, right? I mean, Martin Luther King famously said that a riot is the language of the oppressed. Donald Rumsfeld, during the riots in Iraq, when the United States went into Iraq, he said that the rioting is the beginning of freedom. So the reality is that most people understand that protest, and I agree with you, let's make distinct protest from riot. But the idea of people going out into the streets to have a voice because there's no other way is something that happens to communities or demographics or even situations where people haven't had a voice that's been recorded. But what I want to say is time evolves. And right now, if you look at the speed with which the perpetrator of the George Floyd murder was arrested, it was incredibly fast, right? So the video was taken on the 25th of May. I think it was Memorial Day. The outcry, the public outcry, which really was pretty much across the board, across the United States, caused the mayor of the city to get up and say, this was uncalled for, this is unconscionable, this man should be arrested. That in and of itself is different, right? You and I remember 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, that would never have happened. There wouldn't have been a mayor of a major city who would have stood up unequivocally and said, this is wrong. I want to see my law enforcement division take action. It would have been slow.
Mariam, I think there was also another addition to that, which he also stated that the other three officers who were standing there, that was uncalled for, and they could also get more consequences than just getting fired. And I think that is a first also, because now it breaks the culture of, okay, nobody's going to say anything. Well, I didn't do it.
Right.
I'm not going to say anything if somebody else did it too. Right. So it hopefully will break that culture.
Exactly. And speaking of the culture, that was another thing, Fujian. The fact that they even got fired as quickly as they did, that's evolution and that's progress. And that's a matter of, that wasn't a matter of rioting. That was a matter of having people in the places where they impact policies so that you can see real change. And I think that's what this country is grappling with. The fine line, maybe not the fine line, maybe the very fat line, but the line we have to get to between the protesting and the rioting and the policies actually being implemented and put into place by people who know better, that begins to uproot that systemic racism that most people agree is there. I think that's, you know, that's where we have to rely on change. We have to believe that as people get that voice, as people are able, as you say, to unify their voice and have it be loud, we have to make sure it gets followed up by policies. We have to make sure that some of these activists who are out there protesting are also going home and staying involved and getting into public policy and helping establish the change that actually translates into people's lives. Otherwise, the looting is a momentary expression of frustration and it just goes away. And as you say, it changes the message. It enables some people to say, well, look, I told you so. We have to be tough on crime. And it dilutes the message. So the answer, and you know this because I always say this, the answer is policies. And policies are ultimately politics. And people who say, I don't know, I don't care about politics, it's not true. It's your life. It's how we live, and change comes from policies.
I absolutely agree. And I hope that people will not create a war against each other, because when you go to a small community or a small business and you are looting and breaking, they're barely coming back to business. There are restaurants, there are small shops that are barely coming back to business at this point. Even large organizations or retail stores, which they're all going bankrupt, and they're, you know, if they're bankrupt, they can't offer jobs to people. So going after each other's throat, all it does is you start getting angry at your neighbor, at the people who are there, at any race, at any country people. You're going to put a lot of, you know, slurs are about any type of person, any color out there, because
you end up victimizing a whole new group of people.
Yes, because now the damage is personal, and it's not because of the police, it's not because of the government, but it's another human being and another citizen to another citizen
in your own community.
Right. And this is a time actually we're supposed to hopefully get together, support each other after the pandemic, and still during the pandemic. It's not after the pandemic, it's still going on. Through the pandemic, through all that is coming through, in order to stand by together to against justice, we need each other. We cannot go after each other in that type of destruction.
Yeah. Over the weekend, there was a lot of conversation that was being had in my circles about whether or not the looting was okay. So whether the looting was an extension of the expression of frustration, and so it was excusable, or if the looting was a shift in the expression of justice, and it was now just people with an ulterior motive taking advantage of a situation to take. And we had this conversation, and someone said, well, if they're looting corporate stores, if they're looting the big corporate stores, then it's okay, because those corporate stores are making plenty of money and they're part of the problem. And someone else said, you know, some of those corporate stores are just neighborhood franchise owners. And so you are hurting people, and you're not doing anything good about your message if you are scapegoating a whole different set of people. So we can't go from saying, it's terrible to stereotype African-Americans and treat them badly, and then go over and say, well, okay, but now we can stereotype business owners and we can treat them badly. The idea is that we have to find policies that serve all people, and we all have to stop looking for differences between each other so we can, like you say, find labels that slur. Maybe we should just figure out that we're all people. we all have in common this idea that we're human. We'd all like to live the same way with some measure of dignity in our lives, stability, forward mobility, safety. These are the things that everybody wants. If you yank it from one community, there's going to be resentment. The idea is to come up with a society where we can all, I mean, I know this sounds pie in the sky, but it isn't. Come up with a society where everybody can be treated justly.
Right. And you can, there's a distinct difference between being assertive, being serious, and be taken seriously with your voice versus aggressiveness, because the aggressiveness, all that it creates,
takes away from your voice.
Not only that, but it also promotes aggressiveness again from the police and the, you know, national guard and the military and the government. So you automatically are turning a scenario into more of a dictatorship versus because of now you have an excuse. And we've seen this in all these different countries. We've seen it in Hong Kong and China. We've seen it in Iran. We've seen it in so many other places. That the minute that the public starts doing that, the same conversation that they wanted to have the rights are now going to be taken away because of the violence. So which
makes more frustration.
Yeah. And if it's stated by assertiveness, you're serious and everybody's together in a serious matter and not harming the other citizens, hopefully the message will create amazing policies, and that it would be, those policies would keep everyone safe. Thank you so much, Maddie.
So I want to make one point before you let me go. First of all, I agree with you. You know, aggressiveness begets aggressiveness. Kindness begets kindness. That happens in society. It happens on the ground and in relationships. You know, what you put out there is likely what you get back. But what I want to maybe end on is this idea of aggressiveness out on the streets when people have a cause that they come out for. Like you say, whether it's Hong Kong or Tehran or Los Angeles. You know, here in the States, maybe around the world, but I guess my expectations are higher in the States. Here in the States, we've militarized police. We've been doing it for 10 or 15 or 20 years. It's just that everybody's taken their eye off the ball. You know, while everybody was watching TV and entertaining themselves, all this other stuff happened. And one day we opened our eyes and realized that local police has begun to look like military. And that in and of itself, I think, creates some aggressiveness on the street. There is a whole movement now emerging that's calling for community policing to go back to looking like the community. So instead of sending cops out into communities that look like they're ready for combat, send cops out into communities that look like and are trained to bring peace to communities. And I do think that that's important, and it's an easy do. It's low-hanging fruit, as we say. It's something that can be done. It's something we can all advocate for. You know, make local police forces look more like local police forces instead of foreign military apparatus. And I think that's doable. And that's a first call to action we can all get behind and get this ball moving so that we begin to serve all people in the community and not just have this idea that all police, all military are designed to be aggressive. They're actually designed to resolve problems.
Exactly. Thank you so much. It was a blessing and a joy to speak with you. And how could people find you?
First of all, it's a blessing and a joy to speak with you too, especially because you and I were involved in something that was very humanitarian, and that was a refugee crisis. It's always lovely to see you. People can find me on the Commission on the Status of Women page. They can email me, mariam@mariamzahra.com. They can find me on the Pacific Council for International Policy. They can Google me and see the commentary that I do on various programs, including yours. And more than anything else, people can follow the news, think a little bit, and be involved.
Thank you. And don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Inner Voice.
Are you afraid? Are you getting panic attacks?
Are you getting bored and can't stand it anymore at your home? Are you finding yourself in a bind with a relationship at home? Are you wondering what all of the fuss is? And are you determined to guard yourself against all others? Or worried about how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage? In respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering a sliding scale online psychotherapy for anyone in California and life coaching to anyone in the world who's suffering financially. Please connect with me at foojan.com, foojan.com.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Foojan. Dr. Foojan is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Foojan. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Foojan Zane. You can get it now at foojan.com or amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
Show. I'm Dr. Foojan Zane, and I'm excited to be with Billy Manis today. He is the regularly featured columnist for Elephant Journal, a contributor to Good Men Project and The Fix, a published poet, and a 20-year veteran singer, songwriter, and an author of Kick-Ass Recovery, From Your First Year Clean to the Life of Your Dream. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Zane.
Well, I went through your book and I'm loving it and every aspect of it. So tell me a little bit first about your journey until you got to want to write the book.
Oh, okay. I went to my first meeting, I guess, in 2010 and realized I had to stop using and start to get clean. And at that point, I had nothing really going on. I was unemployed. I was, it was a tough situation. Like a lot of people when they're starting in recovery, they've lost pretty much everything. And I did. And little by little, I started building my life up again. And after about a year of continued recovery, I started volunteering at the jail in my county to go and speak to the people there. And I was telling them my story as I was going on. And it was, I was telling it to them in real time, basically. So as I was outside learning how to drive a truck and getting a career and starting to make money that I had never made before, I was telling them this as I was going into the jail every week with the level of excitement of somebody who had never made that much money before. And the excitement, I, in retrospect, was contagious. And so before I would leave every day, they would kind of like corner me and be like, how do we do this? How, when we get out, I'm getting out in June. Can I do something like, and I would tell everybody how they could follow my footsteps and do the same thing and learn how to go from subsistent living to thriving. I mean, for guys like us making, 70, 75 a year was like unheard of. It was for other people. It wasn't for us. And so that level of excitement, like I said, it was spreading. And that's when it dawned on me, you know, somebody should, instead of like all of these books about how to become a millionaire in 3 weeks, how about, you know, I write a recovery book where I teach people how to go from, you know, living in abject poverty to being able to support themselves and get out of constant lack.
Which is much needed, and thank you. You talk in your book, taking a peek at the past helps you create a better future. And you also talk about, and you're absolutely accurate about using, starts off as fun and then it becomes fun with problems and then it just becomes problems. And I've worked with a lot of, you know, I've worked with addiction for about 30 years now. And the dynamic of addiction has changed a lot because I think the younger generation are utilizing, starting to use much earlier than 30 years ago. And they have accessibility to much more variety of drugs and pills and the combination of all of it. Some people have started with pain and with pain medication and went to opiates, but many people are just beginning with marijuana in a very young age and then moving along, you know, either just staying there or utilizing others. What was your story? How did you start and how did it develop into becoming either a functional and then at one point non-functional disease for you?
Well, I had a, you know, like a lot of people, we all have this similar story of having a tough childhood where we felt alienated. I'll just keep it on myself. I had a tough childhood where I felt very alienated from others constantly. Nothing was happening for me on the same timeline as my peers. And it just made me feel like I wasn't a part of ever. As they were dating, as they were going to proms, as they were having their first relationships, because of the rootlessness and the moving, I just moved constantly. And I never could gain traction in any of the places I moved to. I was always kind of like, I felt like I was just floating in the ether as everybody had these connections going on. And so I always felt out of place and not comfortable in my skin. So the first time I smoked pot, I had this revelation where I felt like it was an incredible feeling. I finally felt like I felt the way most people felt all the time, which I felt like I could never get to that level of that baseline of happiness that most people had. And so the decision was made almost immediately where I said, I'm never not going to use a mind-altering drug again. Like, this is it. This is it. This is how I'm going to deal with reality. This is the first time I felt like I wanted to even be on this planet. So from that point, obviously, pot is only going to last for so long. And then, you know, you just keep seeking out more and more more profound drug issues at that point. And so I went from that to pills and then finally heroin, you know, and if there was like six or seven other things, I would have gone in that direction. But the way it was when I was younger, heroin was pretty much once you were there, that was the last stop on the train. So so that's when everything, it doesn't take long before you get to that point where things just start crashing down around you. And that is how it happened.
And it's important to know that the story that you have is among the story that a lot of people have, because the opioid killing right now is the highest level of death in the United States. So your story, some parts of your story are very familiar for a lot of people who are out there. You also talk about name your why and gift of desperation. And you said you need to have a desire to break free from your addiction that is almost bigger than your desire to be alive. And yours was a definiteness of purpose where there was a little child involved, and it seems like it took you into a whole different direction. Can you share with us?
Well, the definiteness of purpose, that that was referring to in my early years of recovery. I had already stayed abstinent from using, but I wasn't really doing much with my life except going to meetings and staying clean. And so when I realized that I had a child on the way, it wasn't my first child. My first child became sort of estranged because of my using. So when I was expecting another child and I was clean for the first time and I had what I considered a significant amount of clean time, a year and a half or so, I was filled with this sense of purpose where I said, this time it's going to be different. This time I have a chance at doing something, you know, great. And that was my definiteness of purpose. And then from that point, I mapped out a life for myself, you know, so I it was all done very basic. What can I do to make the most money with the least amount of, education? Because there was no time at that point for me to go back to college. I needed to figure something out and raise my income as fast as I could. And so I was listening to a lot of personal development at the time, and it was carrying me the whole way. I would just play those Personal Power Tony Robbins tapes until they were just warped, because they were just inspiring me every day to try different things and to, you know, and that's what led me to truck driving school.
Yeah, Tony Robbins is amazing. What got you into finally saying no and wanting to go through recovery?
It was right around the time I just turned 40, which was almost 10 years ago. I was faced with a life or death situation. I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And the doctors, when I would go to the emergency room, which was at that point, right before I got clean, was happening quite often. Every 3 or 4 weeks, I would wind up in the emergency room. They just told me, listen, you can't half step this. You either have to stop everything and change your entire life right now, or you're not going to make it to your next birthday. I have to be straight with you. You're looking at certain death at this point. And that was a tough thing to hear at 40 years old. But I did. At that point, I left that hospital after like the third time in a matter of 2 months. And I just got on a bus to the next town to get to a meeting. And it was almost like I was on autopilot. I knew I needed to do something. And on that first drive to that meeting, it dawned on me that this was it. There was not going to be any trying again. I just knew there was a significant change that happened inside of me where I knew things were about to become very different.
It's interesting that you say that. And I worked with a lot of addicts, which when they're using, obviously they're destroying their life and they're bottom line killing themselves. Some of them wish to die, so they contemplate about all the ways that they can die. And then there's an illness, or the doctor says, that's it, you know, you're going to die, or they get a cancer, or some type of an illness, which mortality is right here. And suddenly, the desire to live shows up. And I've seen this consistently. You know, I have had another client who was completely hooked on pills, painkillers, and she wanted to die. And part of the conversation was consistently about suicide and dying. And she was then diagnosed by cancer. And just being diagnosed by cancer kicked in, you know, the desire to living and beating this cancer out of her life. And it's amazing how much at times we are destroying ourselves, but when death comes out of our control, like it's here and it's going to be, we're no longer going to have control over it, the desire to survive shows up. And it's almost the same thing I'm hearing from you, which you were destroying your body, but not necessarily realizing it. But when the doctor said, dude, you're going to die,
something kicked in and said, no, I want to live. And then, thank God, you lived and you created an amazing life for yourself. Moving on in your book is creating a life on your own term now. And you talk about upping your value and looking at what is it that you can, you will be contributing to the world that will qualify you for the abundance you're seeking to acquire in your life. I really like the sentence that you wrote. What will you be contributing to the world that will qualify you for the abundance you're seeking to acquire in your life? And you also talk about, you know, naming your sacrifice. What is it that you need to do? And then you go on giving practical tools to people, the same way you said you were giving practical tools, you know, and as you were going into prisons and different locations and sharing with people. Tell us what it is that you saw at that moment where you needed to get up. And obviously your second child was a factor which you said, now I want to give back and I want to give who I am in a different way to the world and to the child that's coming coming in my life.
Oh, so what was it that sparked that, that or inspired me to want to contribute more?
Yes.
Okay. Initially, to be perfectly honest, it was my desire to pull myself out of poverty. That's how it all began. So it began as a very kind of self-serving thing, and then it grew as time went on. It grew into serving others. I believe that that's they always bring up that the example of on the plane when they tell the mother to put the oxygen mask on herself first, and before they put it on the child, because you need to be functioning before you can help others. So I don't feel terribly embarrassed by the fact that it started in kind of a selfish, I need to get myself out of this muck. Because once, like I said, once we become self-sufficient, now all of a sudden we start looking around for more good feeling. And how does anybody get more good feeling but helping others? As a matter of fact, that a lot of studies have been done where that releases more dopamine than almost anything else is to provide for others or to be there for others. And so, you know, it started out as just being more of a contributor to society as a truck driver, instead of just, you know, a guy that was driving a cab in an inner city. And then from there, I just wanted to, you know, I fell in love with feeling a part of and like a contributor. And so that I wanted to contribute other things. And I knew, you know, I was a good writer, so I wanted to share that. And I wanted to, you know, and help others with my story. And then, went from blogs to writing the book to, you know, to helping in jail and helping people in jail and just, you know, so that's how it all began.
Share with people and how to change their thoughts and definitely based on that change their life. And when you decide to change your life, you also say the first thing is setting up a goal, start making $1,000 a week, find the resources and then show up. Find the resources and show up and do the work. And that's what you've done. And in your book, you've actually put 50 different states, vocational rehabilitation offices that people can go and find how they can start, anywhere they can start. You give them ideas about how to start anywhere, whether they're driving Uber or you know, using if they have a car to do something, if not, to look at it. So you're giving them practical tools, which you have seen, and then you've also looked at what is it that other people can do. Can you share with us some of those tools?
Oh, yeah. Well, I put that in the back of the book, the grants for education, for the vocational education, because I learned as I was going into the jails and talking to people that many people did not know that these grants or these services existed. So I was noticing that a lot of people were living in situations that they could have very easily pulled themselves out of, but did not, just didn't realize that, you know, there's no big advertisement telling people, hey, listen, we can give you money to help you, you know, earn three times more income in the matter of, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. So that was the reason I did that. And I also noticed that when I had to do that for myself, I needed to support myself while I was going to this school during the day, because, you know, as I said in the book, nobody was going to pay my rent while I was going to school. So the desire just carried me to work at night and go to school during the day. And I just felt like if I had people who were in the same situation as myself, they're going to have to do the same thing, because nobody is going to say, listen, don't worry about paying rent for the next 3 months. Just go to school and, you know, I'll take care of your car payment, your insurance, that's not reality. So I wanted to put in ideas on how to do some side hustles while you're going to school, because it is entirely possible as somebody who's actually done it. I wanted to share that with others.
Yes, you've done a great job in the book. I really recommend the book. You also complete the book with some of the chapters about how to kick up your faith in the universe and find your calling and rehearse your happiness. And the most important piece is creating an environment of success. And you have over 50 tips at the end of the book, which is very important. They're wonderful tips where you, everyone, you can also find the book and all that Billy Manis does in billymanis.com. In 1 minute, Billy, if you were going to share something that we haven't shared together and you really wanted our viewers and listeners to know about, what would that be?
If you're in a situation where you need to change your life drastically, it can look very overwhelming, and you know, you just may never find the energy in that situation to want to make those changes. And I think that's what usually keeps people in that hamster wheel. I think the thing that people need to know is you just have to start with one little thing. Just do one little thing today. You can still use, just get to a meeting, do something. And once you get in a situation where you're doing one thing every day, it, before you know it, you'll be sitting in Seattle drinking coffee.
That's where you are right now, in Seattle drinking.
Yes.
Yes. Well, it was a pleasure having you on the show. And I hope that everyone will go to billymanis.com and get the book Kick-Ass Recovery or Amazon. And read this book, give it to, if you are going through recovery or if you know someone who's going through recovery, this is an amazing book. It has very specific ways of supporting you and helping you. And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. Bye-bye.